Well, good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program. The Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools are here every Saturday to defend and to promote public education. And we're a bit different from a lot of the other people who are trying to fight for public education because we're prepared to state the obvious. There's a lot of talk about equality of opportunity in Australia. But the dogs contend that you can't even start to talk about equality unless you talk about equal schools. And the only schools that treat children equally are those that are free and secular, with no requirements of parents or children. If they walk in the front gate, then they are entitled to an education, no discrimination, and they have a universal curriculum, which is agreed. So we have a press release 1067 in which we are going to argue that educational equality should start with equal schools. Over to you, Andy.
Thanks, Jean. And this is the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools press release number 1067. Educational equality should start with equal schools, schools that are free, secular, and universal. The sad refrain of growing social inequality fuelled by educational disadvantage continues in both academic and mainstream media. The most recent is Australia's school system is driving inequality, not fixing it, by Chris Bonner in John Menadue's Pearls and Irritations. What does disadvantage look like in Australia? New research shows who's struggling the most from The Conversation and Jane Caro's new Vantage Point essay, Rich Kid, Poor Kid, The Battle for Public Education. Chris Bonner articulates the problem as follows and traces the current situation back to the 1970s. Collectively, our schools are characterised by unfairness, segregation, and growing achievement gaps, problems which impact other areas of social policy and contribute to multiplying costs. Schools should certainly be in the queue for policy attention. Given the scale of existing problems, it seems odd to restate why action is needed. Individual schools aside, our evolving school framework has created the most wicked of social problems. Worse, it exists within a vicious cycle, captive to an enormous regressive feedback loop. The casualties among young people, schools and communities continue to mount. It is now possible to argue that schools are the nurseries for social inequality. This is illustrated in a five-stage cycle, which shows how the key drivers are found in the way the whole framework operates. Yes, schools have never been equal, but much of the current inequality, especially the unlevel playing field on which schools operate and compete, derives from both policy and negligence going back to the 1970s. Stage one, an unlevel playing field. Schools have unequal obligations, operation, resources, and outcomes. Some must be open to all, others charge fees or set tests. Stage two, this creates less diversity within schools and more social and achievement gaps between them. Greater peer impact on outcomes. Stage three, some students and schools win, others lose. Overall student achievement declines, sending schools hunting for good students. Stage four, increasingly, schools are judged on results, further widening the gaps between them in image, presentation, achievements, and challenges. And stage five, choice decisions by families able to choose further drive enrolments towards the more advantaged schools in all sectors. Our equity and fairness problems have changed as governments have come and gone, but what is described at each stage around the cycle is enduring and will be familiar to those with even a passing interest in schools. After half a century, the problems depicted are now too big to ignore. The dog's point of view. Dogs would like to cut through the psychosocial analysis, useful and important as it may be, to a very simple point. If a nation wants all of its children to have an equal chance in the country's educational institutions, then they would make those institutions equal. Countries with successful education systems like Finland know this. The only way to do this is to make every publicly funded school free, open to all children regardless of their social or economic background or the religion of their parents, and with universal curriculum choices. Since the 1960s, Australian education has been bedevilled with the public funding of schools which charge fees, discriminate against children, parents, teachers and employees on the basis of class, creed and gender and other things, and refuse to follow a creed curricula. Dogs predicted the current grossly unequal situation in 1964 when the first trickle of state aid came into the private sector under the guise of library and science blocks. By the 1990s, the millions had become billions, and by the 2020s, Australian society is one of the most segregated in the world. It is the old impossible problem: state aid for private religious schools and separation of religion from the state. There is integrated diversity in a public system, and there is segregated diversity in a private system. Bite into the real problem and you will be vilified, called sectarian by the sectarians. So those who want to be politically correct and nice, try and ignore it. When will the Chris Bonners, Jane Caros and other academic commentators have the intestinal fortitude to bite the bullet and state the obvious? Back to you, Jane.
Although we might be a little bit more straightforward than Chris Bonner and others, that doesn't mean to say that what he has to say shouldn't be taken very seriously, because he's a great guy who's given his life to the public sector as a teacher and a principal and as one of the heads of the Principals Association. So let's hear from Chris Bonner what he has to say about Australia's school system is now driving inequality and not fixing it.
Thanks, Jean. And now here is the entire article by Chris Bonner that appeared on the Pearls and Irritations blog. There will be a little bit of repetition in this, as we just covered some of these points in our press release, but it's worth repeating them in full in context of the entire essay. Australia's school system is driving inequality, not fixing it. Australia's school system has become a self-reinforcing cycle of inequality, and without structural reform, the divide between advantaged and disadvantaged students will continue to widen. It seems that the Albanese government is contemplating better policy ideas than those found amongst the usual low-hanging fruit. Advocates for policy breakthroughs, including those seeking structural reform of our framework of public and private schools, are almost certainly paying close attention. Collectively, our schools are characterised by unfairness, segregation, and growing achievement gaps, problems which impact other areas of social policy and contribute to multiplying costs. Schools should certainly be in the queue for policy attention. Given the state of existing problems, it seems odd to restate why action is needed. Individual schools aside, our evolving school framework has created the most wicked of social problems. Worse, it exists within a vicious circle, captive to an enormous regressive feedback loop. The casualties among young people, schools, and communities continue to mount. It is now possible to argue that schools are the nurseries for social inequality. This is illustrated in the diagram below, which shows how the key drivers are found in the way the whole framework operates. Yes, schools have never been equal, but much of the current inequality, especially the unlevel playing field on which schools operate and compete, derives from both policy and negligence going back to the 1970s. An uneven playing field. Stage 1. Schools have unequal obligations, operation, resources, and outcomes. Some must be open to all, others charge fees or set tests. Stage 2. This creates less diversity within schools and more social and achievement gaps between them, greater peer impact on outcomes. Stage 3. Some students and schools win, others lose. Overall student achievement declines, sending schools hunting for good students. Stage 4. Increasingly, schools are judged on results, further widening the gaps between them in image, presentation, achievements, and challenges. And stage 5. Choice decisions by families able to choose further drive enrolments towards the more advantaged schools in all sectors. Our equity and fairness problems have changed as governments have come and gone, but what is described at each stage around the cycle is enduring and will be familiar to those with even a passing interest in schools. After half a century, the problems depicted are now too big to ignore. The sequence illustrated in the cycle hasn't been lockstep. Many stages overlap. Any stage can be a starting point. What matters is that the flow continues. The cycle helps explain what we have created and understand what went wrong and why reforms to date haven't fixed it. The resulting drama, with multiple impacts on families, schools, and communities, plays out in full view in just about every Australian community. It includes the stress within some families over school choice and the discontent in others without any choice. The fallout from our dog-eat-dog system impacts on family well-being, health and housing, urban transport, and quality of life. Well known is the dollar cost of exercising school choice. With each passing decade, even more public and private funding is found to feed a process and structure which has always been highly contested and which clearly doesn't deliver. Families have looked to the bank of grandma and granddad to cash in superannuation or have just become resigned to more family debt. It all further distorts the schooling system. An entire industry of coaching is available for those who seek access to any low-cost test entry school. Well-resourced schools offer scholarships, effectively ensuring that the school is available to some students. Higher income families might relocate to the drawing area of a preferred public school, almost without exception, located in a high SES suburb. The distortions don't end there. The fact that high test scores have become the go-to measure of school quality means that the most influential actors and stakeholders in school education focus on that, at a cost to everything else schools achieve for their students, including high engagement and a secure post-school pathway. Unsurprisingly, the winning schools are not interested in broadening the rules of the game, including measures of school achievement. Their voting families are unlikely to support any change, which might even seem to reduce their advantage, and the various school authorities are unwilling to risk their purpose and careers by pushing for essential structural reform. A range of vested interests, including school, system, and industrial peak groups, have gained a disproportionate influence over policy. Self-interest and financial challenges also ensure that structural change is usually not on the radar of think tanks and the philanthropic sector. Many school reformers confine their concerns to what happens within schools, preferring remedies which will attract political and funding support. These groups haven't kept up with the growing scale and impact of the regressive cycle. The enrollment divergence between high and low SES schools, mainly but not only between the school sectors, is no longer a steady linear drift. Since around 2017, it has become exponential, a compounding acceleration. This difference matters. Incremental deterioration might be addressed by the familiar within-school reforms. Their advocates make a lot of noise and attract superficial media attention, but the external problems created and driven by the regressive cycle can only be slowed and reversed by structural reform. There are glimmers of hope. Governments around Australia have committed to better understand and provide advice to education ministers on socioeconomic diversity, its impact on schools and student learning, and approaches to addressing these impacts. It's too little too late. Anyone equipped with a computer, the data and the research can complete the task in a few days. As it currently stands, the commitment looks like a proposal to slowly do very little while ignoring possible solutions. The timidity of governments stands in contrast to the impetus now being generated by outsiders. The work undertaken by Australian Learning Lecture is illustrative. Its Choice and Fairness, a Common Framework for All Australian Schools, presented the problems and its solutions. In response to the interest, the next step was to send a team to Canada to research the possibilities best encompassed in their report, Lessons from Canada, an Equal School System is Possible. These are not the first or the only efforts to shift thinking, but a global search for best practice is a timely admission that we got it wrong, and we must now reach beyond our shores for a viable pathway to something better. And you can find that full article by Chris Bonner on John Menadue's Pearls and Irritations blog, or you can go to our press release at www.adogs.info and find a link for it there, as well as the diagram discussed. Back to you, Jean.
Well, it isn't only the children in public schools that are being shortchanged by the governments, Labor and Liberal throughout Australia. It's the teachers who've been shortchanged too. They're overworked and undervalued. Let's hear from Dale about this.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article from The Educator. Overworked and undervalued. Teachers escalate industrial action. Victoria's public school staff are escalating their industrial action as Term 2 begins, banning written report comments, refusing to roll out new government initiatives, and escalating stop work measures in a push for fair pay, better conditions, and full funding. Teachers, principals, and support staff will also skip some meetings and ignore department emails, according to an existing ban on visits from Labor MPs. As part of its escalating industrial dispute with the Allan government, the Australian Education Union's Victoria branch said staff will again walk off the job for half a day on a rolling region-by-region basis starting in state budget week. The latest crisis was triggered after the Allan government rejected the union's demand for a 35% pay increase and improved working conditions and presented a 17% counteroffer that the union called completely unacceptable. On 24th of March, the union began a statewide full-day stop work action, the first such action in 13 years, with more than 35,000 public school staff marching in Melbourne's CBD and rallying at the Victorian Parliament. Despite the impasse, Victoria's Education Minister and Deputy Premier Ben Carroll said he was committed to getting a deal that gives the state's teachers nationally competitive wages. They are so important to Victoria's future, and I'm urging the union to continue, as they have been, negotiating with faith, Carroll said. We are having accelerated bargaining right now, and I'm hopeful that we can get a deal with our teachers to give them the nationally competitive wages and conditions they deserve. On the 10th of April, following the union's threat to escalate industrial action, Carroll said he'd been holding meetings with the union four times a week and would continue pursuing a fair and reasonable deal for teachers. Overworked and undervalued. In a statement, AEU Victoria branch president Justin Mullaly said staff had been pushed to breaking point, with Victoria home to the nation's lowest funded public schools and lowest paid teachers, alongside underpaid principals and support staff. Victoria's public school staff are overworked and undervalued, with the average school employee doing 12 hours of unpaid overtime a week and experienced teachers set to earn over $15,000 less than their New South Wales counterparts by October. It is a similar story for many education support staff and school leaders, Mullaly said. These are the dedicated professionals whose work helps to shape the course of children and young people's lives. But Premier Jacinta Allan and Education Minister Ben Carroll are taking them for granted. Mullaly said the solution was clear and long overdue, warning that without urgent action, the pressures facing schools would only deepen. If they care about public school students and families and want to properly address chronic staffing shortages, they need to immediately fully fund public schools and offer public school staff pay increases that properly reflect the value of their work. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Dale, and I think we've earned a break.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
We hope you're still listening to the Dogs program, because we've got some further research which I'm sure will interest our listeners, the listeners of 3CR. Education is only one of the factors that is leading to an inequality in Australia. We all know that the haves are getting more and the have-nots are getting less, so things are getting worse. So what does disadvantage look like in Australia? There's been new research that shows who's struggling most, and Sorrel is going to tell us about it.
Thanks, Jean. This article was originally published in The Conversation and is entitled, What Does Disadvantage Look Like in Australia? New research shows who's struggling most. The Australian government just released the 2026 report of the Economic Inclusion Advisory Committee. The committee was asked to explore ways to reduce barriers to economic inclusion for people who experience severe disadvantage. A crucial part of this task is to identify who are the most disadvantaged groups in Australia. Disadvantage is a concept that goes beyond income poverty to encompass people's outcomes, including deprivation and social exclusion. So what does disadvantage look like in Australia today? The most comprehensive study of Australia's disadvantage is the Productivity Commission's 2013 report. The report detailed approaches to measuring social and economic disadvantage between 2001 and 2010. The Economic Inclusion Advisory Committee's report draws on this framework, but updates its findings using 24 years of data from the Household Income and Labour Dynamics in Australia, the HILDA survey. The report looks at disadvantage using a range of metrics. Income poverty. Income poverty is measured based on the resources available to households. How much money households have coming in compared to a poverty line. People are said to be in poverty when their resources are below this line. Using a poverty line set at half Australian median income before housing costs, poverty increased from 11.4% of the households in 2010 to 14.2% in 2022, then fell to 12.6% in 2024. Half of all public housing tenants and 38% of people receiving income support payments were in income poverty in 2022. Deprivation. The deprivation approach seeks to measure the outcomes of inadequate resources. These are measured as the extent to which people are missing out on purchasable items, activities or services regarded as essential by a majority of the population because the items were not affordable. Examples include medical or dental treatment when needed, home contents insurance, and at least $500 in savings for an emergency. The most widely experienced deprivation in 2022 was lacking home contents insurance, 7.7%, followed by lacking $500 in savings for an emergency, 7.4%, not having comprehensive motor vehicle insurance, 4.3%, and not being able to afford dental treatment when needed, 4.1%. For most of these indicators, deprivation was stable or declining over this period. In 2014, 80% of the population experienced no deprivation at all. By 2022, this had increased to 84%. While the experience of multiple deprivations has become less common, 4% of the overall population experienced three or more deprivations in 2022. For people receiving income support, multiple deprivations are much more common. Around 30% of people receiving income support experienced deprivation in 2022, and more than 10% experienced three or more deprivations. Social exclusion. Social exclusion is also a multidimensional concept that relates to someone's inability to participate or engage in key economic, social, and political activities. Like deprivation, it's mostly an outcomes-focused measure of disadvantage, although some indicators of social exclusion also reflect people's capability to effectively participate in society. The report looks at trends in 28 indicators measured over 7 key life domains: material resources, employment, education and skills, health and disability, social connection, community characteristics, and personal safety. Low well-being in the material resources domain has been broadly stable since 2001, while the employment domain shows mixed trends. Unemployment fell from 2001, rose significantly during COVID, and then fell to lower levels. Long-term unemployment has fallen more. The share of jobless households fell significantly from 14% to 9% at the end of the period. The education domain shows more significant changes likely to reduce disadvantage. Low education has nearly halved from around 40% to closer to 20%. Poor English has also fallen, but is much lower. Low work experience has generally fluctuated between 11 and 13%. The trend is less encouraging in health. Poor general health ranges between 17% and 20%, but started to exceed 20% in 2018 and 2019 and has been 21 to 22% since 2001. Poor mental health has increased from 9.3% in 2011 to above 14% since 2020. The share of the population with a long-term health condition has increased from 23.9% in 2001 to 29% or higher since 2020. Personal safety shows improvements, with the share experiencing personal violence falling from 2.1% to 1.4%. Those being a victim of property crime fell from near 7% to under 3%, and those feeling generally unsafe fell from 6.5% to under 2% since 2001. Deep social exclusion. To be deeply excluded, a person has to experience exclusion from at least 7 of the 28 indicators for the different life domains. The extent of deep social exclusion has increased from 5.6% of people aged 15 and over in 2010 to 6.6% in 2022. The Productivity Commission ranked the groups identified as more likely to experience multiple forms or deeper disadvantage in 2010. This ranking has not changed over the subsequent 12 years. By far, the highest rates of deep social exclusion in 2022 were experienced by people who are unemployed, 38.8%, public housing tenants, 36.5%, people receiving income support, 20.5%, people with long-term health conditions or disability, 16.3%, people with low educational attainment, 16.3%, lone parents, 15.7%, and Indigenous Australians, 15.5%. For public housing tenants, people who are unemployed, people receiving income support, and those with low educational attainment, rates of deep disadvantage have increased significantly. For Indigenous Australians, rates of deep disadvantage nearly doubled between 2010 and 2014, but then fell back, although still remain higher than in 2010. Persistent disadvantage. While some people move in and out of disadvantage relatively quickly, others can remain disadvantaged for many years. The longer a person is disadvantaged, the harder it is for them to escape. The extent of deep and persistent social exclusion, those experiencing deep social exclusion for 4 or more years between 2015 and 2024, is the highest for public housing tenants, 27.8%, and those receiving income support, 23.4%. These rates have risen since 2001 to 2010. Over this period, there have been major changes in who is in public housing and who is on income support, with both groups reducing as a share of the population. Population ageing has had an impact. The share of the population experiencing deep and persistent exclusion who are over 60 increased from 11.7% to 19.5%. Between 2001 and 2010, 63% of those experiencing deep and persistent exclusion were women. But in the 2015 to 2024 period, this had fallen to just under half. By family type, the largest increase was for single-person households, who went from 8.8% to 16.3% of those deeply and persistently excluded. Deep and persistent social exclusion for Indigenous people, 19.2%, is much higher than for non-Indigenous, 3.9%, but has fallen slightly since 2001. So while more in-depth analysis is required to identify what's causing these trends, it's clear there are key cohorts that need dedicated attention to boost quality of life. Back over to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Sorrel, for all your work that you do for the dogs. And now we're going to one of the other things that we've been trying to inform people about, the strange new world of AI. Let's hear from Andy, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. In some schools, chatbots interrogate students about their work, but the AI revolution has teachers worried. And this was published in The Guardian on the 23rd of Feb. Once upon a time, school students would submit an essay and teachers would mark it. Job done. Enter thinking mode. Now, in some Australian schools, once a student finishes an assignment, an AI chatbot will interrogate them about it, put them on the spot in a two-way dialogue to make sure they really understand what they wrote. Can you explain this a little bit more, the chatbot might say, or what do you mean by that word? It's not just about hammering in the lesson, it's also a way to ensure students do their own thinking and haven't resorted to plagiarism or ChatGPT. But while AI is being rolled out at Australian schools in innovative ways, it is not coming to all of them and not equally. The peak body for independent schools is urging the federal government to take up a national AI pilot or risk creating a two-speed system and widening educational divide. The Independent Schools Australia, ISA, paper released on Monday analysed how schools across the nation were integrating generative AI into teaching and learning 3 years after the release of ChatGPT. It found schools were adopting AI at widely varying speeds, depending on their geography and resources. Just two jurisdictions, New South Wales and South Australia, have rolled out AI programs to public schools after a ban on the technology was overturned in late 2023. The chief executive of ISA, Graham Catt, said Australia was at a critical point in determining whether AI became a tool for equity or inequality. If we don't act deliberately now, we risk creating a two-speed system, Catt said. Some schools will surge ahead while others struggle to keep up. The paper called on the federal government to launch a national sector-blind pilot AI program to provide a pathway on how to ethically adopt the technology and where to direct funding. The latest Teaching and Learning International survey, TALIS, released in 2024, found two-thirds of Australian teachers in secondary years and just under half of primary school teachers used AI in their work, placing the nation among countries with the highest uptake of the technology. But teachers also expressed caution about the negative impacts on student well-being AI could cause, privacy issues and the possibility for plagiarism, indicating a need for better guidance and safeguards. New South Wales EduChat, a department-owned generative AI tool, has been rolled out to all public schools in New South Wales to help teachers with lesson planning and students to study by asking guided questions to encourage critical thinking. South Australia's EdChat chatbot was also distributed statewide in 2025. Early results show it has saved time for teachers and particularly helped students with language or learning barriers. O'Rourke says teachers are scrambling to try to understand how technology is changing and need proper training. We can't teach our kids how to use it responsibly if teachers don't know how to use it responsibly. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Andy. It's great to have somebody who has some understanding of the implications of the artificial intelligence. But shall we now go to Jeff, who's our expert, of course, on international news. Over to Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. While the US provides continually an example of why good public education is very important, I'm going to avoid it still. I've found a couple of interesting stories from around the world. This one's from Tunisia. Why education reform in Tunisia has stalled since 2023. This is in the Middle East Monitor. It begins, understanding the crisis. Since 2023, Tunisia's education system has been repeatedly disrupted by strikes, grade boycotts, and escalating confrontations between teacher unions and the Ministry of Education. Each year, nearly 100,000 students drop out of school, an average of roughly 300 dropouts a day, highlighting the persistent challenges facing the system. At the peak of the crisis, authorities suspended the salaries of more than 17,000 teachers after they refused to submit student grades. These disruptions are not isolated incidents, but are part of the broader wave of social unrest. In January 26 alone, Tunisia recorded over 500 protests, nearly half linked to employment conditions and unpaid wages, including those of teachers. Yet the significance of this breakdown becomes clearer when viewed against the central role education has historically played in Tunisia. Since the 1950s, education in Tunisia has been a cornerstone of the country's state-building efforts. For generations of Tunisians, public education offered the main path out of illiteracy and socioeconomic marginalisation. It's precisely this historical role that makes the current deadlock so consequential. Today, negotiations have reached an unprecedented impasse, with little prospect of resolution in the short term. The long political history of the Tunisian General Labour Union, UGTT, accounts for its elevated profile after 2011. The union has been a key actor in Tunisia's struggle for independence, state building after 1956, negotiating workers' rights and supporting the country's democratic transition. This legacy has created a strong perception within the constituencies of the UGTT, including teacher unions, of being true guardians of public education rather than partners in its reform. For instance, over the past decade, teacher unions repeatedly used nationwide strikes and school year disrupting tactics such as nationwide walkouts in 2012 and 2017, and a year-long silent strike throughout the 22-23 school year where teachers withheld student grades to push the Ministry of Education and the wider government into negotiations. This shows how teacher unions have been influential in shaping the directions of the education sector. Today, however, unions' mobilisation capacity has been put in check and their legacy of being the true guardian of public education is being contested. The Ministry of Education, the other side of the debate, is framing reform around state authority, legitimacy and fiscal rationalism rather than compromise. This was evident after both parties signed an agreement on the 23rd of May 23. The deal included phased salary increases of 100 Tunisian dinars per year over 3 years, starting in 26, along with broader commitments to continue sectoral dialogue and address teachers' demands. However, the unions later accused the government of failing to fully implement these commitments. Moreover, the government's recent decision to unilaterally set wage increases for fiscal years 26-27 and 27-28 was described by union leadership as a fatal blow to the bargaining policy that has been fundamental to social peace for decades. These defensive positions reflect an environment that is driven by mutual mistrust and competition over who leads decision-making in the education sector. This stalemate has stifled innovation and initiative taking, and gave way to a mentality of risk aversion amongst teachers, many of whom now say they feel reduced to mere breadwinners rather than shapers of the next generation. This shift in teachers' self-perceptions has also had a chilling effect on students, who define their school experience in terms of attendance and grades rather than life learning, ethical, social and emotional development. This has been reflected in the 23, 24 and 25 baccalaureate exams, where success rates in interior regions such as Kasserine, Gafsa and Jinduba lagged far behind urban and coastal regions, with rates barely exceeding 30%. At the structural level, the top-down approach to education governance has also limited the space for civil society organisations and grassroots actors to participate in enriching school life. In this climate, reform is no longer treated as a shared national project, but as a technically or politically constrained arena that is increasingly difficult for third-party actors to influence. The reform space has become increasingly insular and selective, with limited opportunities for meaningful participation beyond formal consultations or symbolic involvement in predefined processes. Overall, advancing any reform initiative increasingly depends on personal connections and an informal network of insiders rather than broad, transparent debate, which further entrenches the same transactional logic that dominates the core negotiations. These competitive attitudes and the lack of openness towards civil society, youth and women will only hinder any meaningful progress in education reform. Ultimately, the way out of this bottleneck is through renewed collaboration between the government, unions and civil society actors, working toward a shared reform agenda rather than resorting to a tit-for-tat strategies and exclusions. That's the end of the article. And now I will take you across to Eastern Europe. We will go to an interesting publication called the European Roma Rights Centre. Jonathan Lee and Michael Zelizak. This is called ERC Takes Legal Action for the Romani Refugee Children Who Are Denied Education. And it begins, Brussels, 28th of April, 26. The European Roma Rights Centre, ERC, has filed formal complaints with the national ombudsman institutions in the Czech Republic, Hungary, Moldova and Romania, alleging that Romani children fleeing the war in Ukraine are being systematically denied their right to education. The complaints highlight a pattern of discrimination where children face insurmountable barriers to schooling because of their ethnicity and their refugee status, leaving thousands of children in a state of educational limbo. Despite the laws in all four countries guaranteeing free and non-discriminatory access to education for all children, the ERC's findings reveal that Romani refugee children are disproportionately unable to access the school system. While official statistics often show high enrolment rates for Ukrainian refugees generally, these figures mask a stark reality. Many Romani children are formally registered but never attend class due to complex needs. Many are pushed into inadequate online programs without necessary resources or are outright refused entry due to language barriers, lack of documentation, and deep-seated anti-Gypsyism. We are witnessing a second wave of exclusion, said Dorde Jovanovic, president of the ERC. While the world focused on the initial arrival of Ukrainian refugees, a silent crisis has developed for the most vulnerable among them. Behind every statistic is a child sitting at home, unable to learn because they don't speak the language well enough, lack a computer, or are too afraid of bullying to enter a classroom. We're filing these complaints because formal enrolment is a lie if a child never even steps foot in a school. Look past the numbers and ask, why are Romani refugee children in these countries being systematically erased from the education system? This is not just an administrative glitch or policy failure, it's a violation of fundamental rights with intergenerational consequences. The key issues across four countries. Hungary. The complaint alleges that despite a high theoretical enrolment rate, Romani refugee children face severe barriers, including language rejection, placement in part-time programs, and a lack of targeted support. The ERC notes that the Hungarian government's failure to collect disaggregated ethnic data renders the scale of exclusion invisible to policymakers. Furthermore, the historical legacy of segregating Romani children in special schools continues to influence the treatment of refugee children today. Moldova. With nearly 150,000 Ukrainian refugees, Moldova faces a critical gap where 87% of refugee children remain outside the formal education system. The ERC complaint highlights that Romani children are hit hardest by the language barrier, with many speaking Hungarian or Romani rather than Ukrainian. A lack of digital devices for online learning and direct discrimination, citing a recent Equality Council ruling that found a school's refusal to enrol Romani children constituted direct discrimination. Romania. Although over 23,000 Ukrainian children are enrolled, attendance rates are critically low, particularly among adolescents. The ERC reports that Romani refugee children face racial discrimination from both authorities and fellow refugees. The complaint points to a parallel education reality where children are registered but excluded from the protective environment of Romanian schools due to unstable housing, lack of integration support and parental fears of bullying. Czech Republic. While 92% of refugee households report school enrolment, the ERC reveals that actual attendance amongst Romani children is significantly lower. Activists report that parents often enrol children merely to satisfy social protection requirements, knowing that they cannot attend due to language barriers, lack of adaptation groups, and teacher unpreparedness. The complaint underscores the fragmentation of responsibilities between central and local governments, which leaves Romani refugees falling through the cracks. Across all four nations, the ERRC identifies a consistent set of obstacles preventing effective access to education. 1. Data blackouts. The refusal of authorities to collect disaggregated data on ethnicity prevents the monitoring of discrimination and the formulation of targeting policies. 2. Resource deficits. A lack of devices, internet access and school supplies disproportionately affects the impoverished Romani families with additional needs. 3. Language and integration gaps. Insufficient language support and adaptation programs fail to accommodate children who speak Romani, Hungarian or Russian rather than Ukrainian. 4. Anti-Gypsyism. Deep-rooted prejudice leads to bullying, segregation and the active refusal of schools to accept Romani children. The ERRC calls upon the National Ombudsman to launch immediate investigations into these violations. The complaints urge the authorities of the Czech Republic, Hungary, Moldova and Romania to establish robust monitoring mechanisms, including the collection of disaggregated ethnic data in compliance with human rights standards, deploy and fund Romani school mediators to bridge the gap between communities and schools. Implement targeted outreach programs and provide material support, devices, transport supplies to vulnerable families. Next one, enforce strict anti-segregation measures and ensure that enrolment translates into genuine regular attendance. Last one is strengthen cooperation between Romani civil society organisations to design and deliver effective inclusion programs. And it begins, quote, "The right to education is a key to breaking the cycle of poverty and exclusion," Jovanovic added. "By failing to educate these children, these states are condemning a generation to the continual marginalisation in their adopted new home. We expect the Ombudsman's offices to treat these complaints with the urgency they deserve and to hold their respective governments accountable. The ERCC will follow up with the relevant institutions and expects a formal response within the statutory timeframe." That's the end of the article. And I thought it might be interesting to look at the troubles in Eastern Europe as well as the troubles in North Africa for a break from the rest of it all. And with that, I'll bid you a good weekend and cheer up.
Oh, many thanks, Jeff. But let's have a break, shall we?
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card. And once a year, your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Programs provide information and analysis you won't hear in the mainstream.
Today we'll be looking at the legacy of the US war on Vietnam on Laos.
And as far as corporate capitalism is concerned, it is the worst political and economic system that you can have.
Our laws about jailing refugees and asylum seekers are so well crafted.
Sex is not irrelevant and we like who we are, but we don't have to be imprisoned by our gender.
Become a subscriber today. Call us on 9419 8377 or visit 3cr.org.au. 3CR, the voice of dissent.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
We hope you're still listening to the dogs because Dale has got something very interesting for you. The AU, let's hear what they're doing in their travels all the way over to Perth.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article from the AEU. Schools for Our Future Inquiry travels to Perth. The Australian Education Union is bringing its Australia First National Inquiry into Public School Infrastructure to Perth, focusing on how targeted investment can deliver world-class learning environments for every Western Australian student. The inquiry, chaired by Sharon Burrow, is travelling the country to hear directly from teachers, governments and community organisations about how school infrastructure can support high quality teaching and learning now and into the future. The inquiry will also visit schools which have unmet infrastructure needs and those schools that have seen recent state government investments so we can ascertain what is working well and what needs to be improved. AEU Federal President Corinna Haythorpe said Western Australia has a strong foundation to build on, but sustained investment is needed to ensure every school benefits. We know Western Australia has public schools with facilities that are too often outdated, overcrowded, and not fit for purpose. There are also examples of schools that have had significant investment, Ms. Haythorpe said. We see the incredible impact that high-quality facilities can have when schools are properly resourced. The challenge now is uplifting every public school so all students have access to high-quality learning facilities. Consultations in Perth will begin with the Western Australian Education Minister Sabine Winton and bring together principals, teachers and community organisations to identify practical solutions and long-term priorities for school infrastructure investment in Western Australia. New data highlights why action is needed. Commonwealth investment in public school infrastructure in Western Australia has declined sharply over the past decade, falling from an average of 31.6% of total capital funding between 2009 and 2017 to just 1.0% between 2018 and 2024. In 2024, the Commonwealth contribution to capital works in Western Australian schools was effectively zero. That's not sustainable if we're serious about delivering world-class public education, Ms. Haythorpe said. There's a real opportunity right now for the state and federal government to work together and invest in the schools our communities need. Ms. Haythorpe said the inquiry is focused on solutions and long-term planning. This is about getting the settings right for the future. We must ensure our schools have the infrastructure to meet growing student needs and support high-quality teaching, she said. Teachers in Western Australia cannot be expected to deliver 21st century learning in facilities designed for decades past. With the right investment, we can ensure every child in Western Australia learns in a school that is safe, modern, and built for success. The Perth Roundtable forms part of a nationwide consultation process that will inform recommendations to governments on how to deliver equitable, future-focused public school infrastructure across Australia. And it's about time. Back to you, Jean.
Well, now we come to the best part of our program, our great state school.
Thanks, Jean. And this week's Great State School of the Week is Aspendale Primary School. And now the principal's message. On behalf of the Aspendale Primary School community, I extend a warm welcome to you and your family. It is a privilege to lead a school dedicated to providing a high-quality, supportive and engaging environment that builds every student's academic, social and emotional capacity. We are a proud school steeped in tradition whilst engaging in ongoing improvement, utilising evidence-informed practice. Our daily life is guided by our core values: passion, respect, integrity, commitment and empathy. We prioritise student well-being through the Positive Behaviour for Learning framework and the Respectful Relationships curriculum, ensuring an inclusive environment where every student is both supported and challenged. At Aspendale, we develop lifelong learners who care for themselves, others and the community around them and actively contribute to the wider world. We achieve this through a rigorous and relevant curriculum, with literacy and numeracy having dedicated teaching times each day. Our students explore 6 units of inquiry each year as part of the International Baccalaureate Primary Years program, building their knowledge of science and the humanities. Our 5 specialist subjects, physical education, visual arts, performing arts, STEM, which is science, technology, engineering and mathematics, and Chinese Mandarin, allow all students to follow their passion and foster a love of learning. Nestled between Aspendale Beach and the Edith Vale Seaford wetlands, our spacious grounds and orderly learning spaces allow students to flourish. This environment is bolstered by a dedicated staff and a highly supportive parent community, all of whom hold high expectations for student success. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. The current enrolment, 477. And the ICSEA value, above average, at 1100. This means 38% of students are in the top quartile of socio-educational advantage, SEA, 35% in the second top quartile, 20% in the third, and 7% in the lowest 25% of socio-educational advantage. There are no Indigenous students, and 19% have a language background other than English. The finances are a current funding of $1.5 million from the federal government and $5.6 million from the state government. Fees, charges and parent contributions add another $433,000 and other private sources $199,000, which works out to $15,129 per student. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Andy, and congratulations to Aspendale Primary School. But our time is gone. So it's up to me to thank our wonderful producer, Dale, and her offsider, Andy, and of course, Sorrel and Jeff. And from all of us here at 3CR, we would like to recommend you have a look at our website at www.adogs.info. If you've been watching the ABC program on great High Court cases, well, you could go and have a look at what we did with the High Court and what the High Court did to us. I think it is the most important case in the last 100 years anyway. But with all of that, our time is gone. So from all of us here at 3CR, it's bye for now.
Saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air.
Over five decades, we've been home to hundreds of shows, thousands of broadcasters and guests, and hundreds of thousands of listeners.
This February, we're aiming for 1,000 subscribers.
It's just $40 concession, $80 full.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.